Come with us on a journey into the unknown, the unexplained, and the unbelievable. We will test your senses and challenge your beliefs. A world where science and religion clash. Or do they? You will meet real people and hear real stories, but you will not believe. You will witness strange sights and hear strange sounds, but you will not believe. This is the New England Ghost Project. Welcome to the nightmare.
Well, good evening, everyone, except those people in Ohio who are under the tornado watch. Welcome to Ghost Chronicles International. I am Ron Kolick, and I'll leave it at that. And joining me across the pond is the gold standard ghost hunter, the god of infrasound, Mr. Steve Parsons.
I want to know what you've got, why you didn't wish the people of Ohio a good evening.
Well, because they're under a thunder watch. Why would I
want to? Well, a good evening would be don't get hit by a tornado, obviously.
It's a British thing. We don't do that here in the States.
Hey, we had a tornado here in the UK yesterday.
Oh, we don't talk like you guys. You guys talk funny.
Well, we had a tornado here in the UK yesterday.
Did you?
Yes. Yeah. Because per capita, Britain has more tornadoes.
Oh, here we go. Britain has everything more than the United States. We all know that, Steve. You invented everything before the United States had more of everything.
That's true. That's perfectly true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Carry on. We have a guest today, so we can save this.
Yeah.
This later.
Go on then.
Okay.
Well, you introduce our guest because she's probably wondering what the hell she's gotten herself into.
Yes, I'm sure she is by now. Joining us now from from the University of Akron.
Akron.
Well, that too. The Miller Center for the History of Psychology, Dr. Jennifer Fazak. Oh, God.
No worries. It's a long name. We're actually at the Drs. Nicholas and Dorothy Cummings Center for the History of Psychology at the University of Akron. So it is a mouthful.
It is. So, and what is your role there at the,
at the center?
Yeah, center.
Yeah, we can say the museum. Yeah. Right. So I'm the assistant director here. So we actually, to add to some of that confusion under the name, is the Cummings Center is actually an umbrella name for both the National Museum of Psychology, which is probably how you found my name originally, and the Archives of the History of American Psychology, which is the world's largest collection of historical materials related to the discipline.
This is confusing. for my poor, simple mind. So do I have to ask you, do you have a degree in psychology?
I do. And actually, I'm trained as a historian of psychology.
Oh, it's like those. Okay. So
in
is
other
that
news, I've been to Ohio. It's really nice. And I've been to Akron.
Oh, have you? That's wonderful.
Well, we were traveling through on our way to Dayton.
Okay.
So,
and were you here recently enough to have seen the museum?
That's why we were there. We were not your museum. We were going to the U.S. Air Force Museum at Dayton.
Gotcha.
Steve's right. An airplane buff.
Fabulous.
So anyway.
Fabulous museum. I can't comment on your museum, but the U.S. Air Force Museum is a fabulous museum.
Back to the Museum of Psychology.
Well, it was museums in Ohio. I'm a simple creature.
Yeah. So speaking about simple things, so a psychology degree, is that a PhD or is it you can have a bachelor's?
So it depends on what you want to do in the field. I have a PhD because that was what was required for sort of the path that I was on.
Mm-hmm. So is it a BA or a BS?
I have a BA, an MA, and a PhD.
Oh, God bless us. Okay, so here's the deal. I have a BA, oddly enough, in what the
language.
Heck is it? Yeah, language. Yeah. Don't laugh. I was only 6 credits short of a major in English. But I have a BA in environmental science. And So if I was wanted to go and get a degree in psychology, and since it's a BA, I had, you know, I had basic psychologies and some of these social, you know, social stuff. But anyways, how, what would I need to do that, to go beyond my BA in environmental science and get a BA in psychology? Or, yeah.
I mean, if you were just looking for a BA in psychology, I would assume you can just apply. There's no prerequisites in terms of getting into that type of program. It would just be a matter of, you know, applying with your grades and, you know, your experience and all the things they ask on an application. And even at the graduate level, it's not required necessarily that you have, you know, an undergraduate degree in psychology. Some people go on to graduate studies in psychology from other fields. And often, I mean, it can be a really good background that you bring into the discipline. So it really depends on the program and the school, I would think.
Intriguing, very intriguing. Because for some reason, I'm not a young person anymore, by the way. Just, you know, give you a heads up. But
I'm a lifelong learner myself, so I fully endorse continuing education.
Well, I think that's why we're here on this lovely planet, is to learn things. And when we stop learning, we really shouldn't be here, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So, anyways, back to your center. That's what I keep saying. Mm-hmm. So what is the mission of the center? I'm going to call it the center because it's got a big name and I'm going to mess it up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The mission of the center is really to preserve the history of psychology and make it available to as wide an audience as possible. We were originally founded back in 1965 as an archive. So the title was The Archives of the History of American Psychology. But the core foundation of our organization was collecting materials related to the history of psychology and, you know, sort of the related fields. And that includes everything from paper documents to photographs to artifacts, films, audio recordings, and, you know, the collection basically grew over time. And that still is our core responsibility in terms of what we do. The National Museum of Psychology is a more recent unit that we've added to our operations. It opened in 2018 with the goal of, you know, using this really rich collection that we've assembled and making it available to a wider audience through sort of a museum format.
Now, my partner here, Steve Parson, is a councilman for the SPR, which is, parapsychologist is an offshoot of, or is it, I don't know if it's an offshoot or is it a discipline?
I think it was once described as psychology is a fringe science and parapsychology is a fringe of a fringe science.
Very good.
That was described by a psychologist, by the way.
Yeah, but there are a lot of psychologists out there. Anyways, Jennifer, I'm gonna call you Jennifer, if you don't mind.
And I don't mind at all.
Okay, so in the museum, do you kind of ignore the parapsychology and the psychology?
I would say we ignore it, but we don't feature it. It's not in the current permanent displays. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of topics that fall under the umbrella of psychology that are not represented in the current layout of the museum. So it's not certainly the only area that isn't featured. There's only so much floor space. You know, we had to kind of pick and choose. But we have featured parapsychology in programming that we've offered to the public because we do have some items within our collection that speak to the field. And we've got things like, it ranges in terms of eras. So we have examples of spirit photographs that date to the Civil War era, a spirit writing board for automatic writing. In later years, you know, things like the Zenner cards, we've got a Kirlian photography apparatus, you know, things like that. They are represented certainly in the collection itself.
Okay. And I mean, they do you have like special exhibits of them? Maybe so. I assume around Halloween they would be popular. I'm just guessing, but it seems like everything's popular about parascience and parapsychology and Halloween.
That does tend to be the time of year where we get requests for it. Yeah. We do have a rotating exhibit space. So different topics are featured in there regularly because, again, you know, not every psychology topic is featured in the museum itself. And so we try to rotate through other topics within the collection, you know, sort of on an annual basis. And you're absolutely right that October tends to be a time when, you know, we've been asked to bring out some of the more parapsychology related type materials, you know, when we do some programming or, you know, attend community events and things of that sort.
Okay. You know, psychology is probably the most misunderstood discipline of all, I think, of all the sciences, in that people don't really know what it is in regards to, you know, they either have their you know, their thoughts is like, you know, somebody laying on a couch and somebody's telling them their problems and blaming their mother, or it's you know, something on the other end where if you're in our field, it's you know, somebody sitting in the laboratory flashing Zener cards to someone else.
I think as well, a lot of people mistake psychology for psychiatry. And
exactly. Steve. That's what I was getting. The point I was getting at.
We'll continue.
Yeah, and that's something we try to tackle in the museum. You know, sort of at the very entrance, we've actually got sort of these two pillars, and they say psychology is all around us. And the first images that our visitors are greeted with are sort of archival images paired with contemporary images to show sort of the ways that psychological research is actually all around us at all times. Like we just don't even realize that we are sort of benefiting from research that has been done in the field. So just a quick example would be, you know, the way that our keypads are laid out on our telephones. You know, that's based on psychological research done by Alphonse Chapanis. And so, you know, he was doing research to see what was the layout that was sort of the most effective, had the least number of errors when telephone operators are putting those numbers in. And so, you know, we take that for granted at this stage in terms of that 3x3 square that we've got. So, you know, there's sort of, we had the expectation that people are not necessarily going to know what psychology is. And to your point as well, Steve, the difference between psychology and psychiatry, which is challenging because they have a shared history, right? So they're hard to tease apart a little bit. The same with philosophy. You know, it's they have these overlapping histories that aren't always really simple in terms of how to differentiate between them.
So if you were to make it really clear for our listeners, what is the big difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
The classic answer, if I sort of go the easy route.
We like classic on this show.
the classic answer is always that, you know, psychiatrists are able to prescribe medications and, you know, hold a medical degree, versus a psychologist is working in other methods, if they happen to even be working in mental health care, and are not typically have, you know, don't typically have prescription privileges or a medical degree. They have a PhD. But the problem becomes that that's one small branch of psychology, right? So, I mean, as you know, I mean, you've got a parapsychologist on the line, you know, there's so many different areas in which psychologists work, that to describe it even in that way as you know, just mental health would be really, you know, sort of limiting.
Now, yeah. I was talking generally in terms of, you know, human perception. When you speak to people and you mention psychology, the layperson often mistakes that for mental well-being, mental health issues, which are more dealt with by psychiatrists. But in terms of psychologists, you know, there are industrial psychologists, there are clinical psychologists. I think there is almost every category of existence has an associated psychologist or psychology and specialists in those fields.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I'm a historian of psychology is kind of interesting too, right?
Yeah, I was recently talking to a food psychologist. A food psychologist. They're not interested
really?
In... Yeah, they don't psychologize food. They're looking at how things are, how food is perceived, how it's presented, how we make choices relating to food, or at least that's how it was explained to me by the food psychologist. But they work in industry as well, so, you know, designing menus and packaging and...
Right, which then overlaps into sort of the marketing side of things where psychology has also been traditionally involved. I mean, it's one of those fields where... you know, just the curiosity around understanding sort of what makes us human is kind of the uniting factor of you know, all these different psychologists, because we're all doing different work, but it all kind of comes back to sort of some of those core principles of just understanding humanity.
Rather like parapsychology, do you think, in your view, do you think that people who are drawn to psychology are essentially curious about people? Or we were having a conversation a few weeks ago, and it occurred to me during the course of the conversation that, I mean, I know a great many of psychologists. I work a lot closely with several university departments of psychology. And it was raised that almost every psychologist has a personal issue, which may, you know, may be a factor in making them more curious or drawing them in to the field to gain a greater insight into their own problems, or is it that they are just curious people who like to explore people around them rather than the world around them and how we interact with the world around them or how people interact?
I suspect it's both, right? I mean, you need a curiosity about people to sort of end up in the field. And we all have some sort of problem at some point. And so there's going to be a natural curiosity about ourselves as part of that, I would think.
It's just, it struck us during the course of the conversation. It was with another psychologist that so many psychologists in our sphere, at the university that we were talking about, all seem to have need a psychologist. and it was like, maybe that's a prerequisite of entry into the field.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, just another way of looking at that could also be that, being in the field also helps take down some of those barriers that prevent members of the general public from sort of accepting mental health services, right? Just from that side of things of, you know, it might lower some of those fears that some people have.
I really think, you know, that trying to understand why things work, how people see and do what they do, is more of I'm not going to say curiosity because it's a little bit more than that. It's truly an understanding. You know, one of the reasons I went into environmental sciences because it was a study of all the sciences. So I wanted to know as much as I could about the different sciences. And isn't it that the same thing though? If a psychologist is studying how people react to various stimuli or so whatever, it's just, you know, they're interested in knowing how they do that or why they do that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Okay. So, Sigmund Freud, I saw in your collection that you have actually films of him when he was, is they family films or did I mistake that?
We do, yeah. No, that's accurate. We have some... silent footage, so it has no sound, and it's family footage from after he sort of escaped Vienna and was in outside of London, I believe. And so it's sort of him and family members sort of and friends lounging around the backyard. Freud is quite elderly by that time. I mean, it's only a few years prior, you know, sort of just ahead of his death. And so he's wrapped up in a blanket, and it's early film days, right? And so there's a lot of people standing around, kind of looking, making eye contact with the videographer. And you know, I think it's kind of fun. It puts a little bit of you know, person behind kind of the theories.
Humanistic.
And pardon me?
Humanistic approach.
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, humanizes. That's actually the great way of saying that. Yeah, so that is definitely a feature in our exhibit. We have a recreation of sort of his famous couch from his office, so that visitors can actually, you know, sort of lie on the couch as they're learning about the arrival of psychoanalysis in the United States.
Now, that's intriguing, Jennifer, because at the Lizzie Borden house, of course, I'm sure you're aware of the Lizzie Borden trial and so forth.
I am, yes.
Yeah, the couch that they have on there, it's a reproduction of the original couch. But that's mm-hmm. what they have there, and that's what all people do. They want to lay in that couch where Borden was killed in Poland. It's something in our makeup that want to do that. We want to be like that person or try to, I don't know, is it, maybe it's to try to understand what he went through.
Don't
by just think laying.
Many people want to be like Borden's father or mother.
But it's intriguing.
Well, and with the couch, I mean, I think it's one of those iconic images of psychology and psychiatry, to be fair, that, you know, again, a lot of visitors just associate with what they expect in a museum of psychology. And so it's nice to be able to kind of, you know, greet them where they are and provide that sort of interactive, because it is a reproduced couch. The original, of course, is still in existence. It's in Europe. There's actually two Freud museums in Europe. And so the majority of his materials live overseas.
Now, speaking of Freud, and it also has to do with your collection as well, is that you have an electric shock machine there, which I want to get into your particular one. But here in the Massachusetts, we are having a big debate now about to stop the usage of electrical shock for behavioral issues, which is being fought by certain psychologists as well. And what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it has a long history in terms of, you know, the different types of shock therapies that were introduced back in sort of the 1930s, 1940s, of which, you know, electric shock was one of them. There was also insulin shock therapy and metrazole therapy. And I mean, the therapies that are offered today are different from those original electroshock machines. So we have one of the older models that was sort of the origins that, you know, people associate with, you know, sort of the metal frame that goes over the head, and it has sort of the two padded pieces that would go on either side of the temples. You know, today it's often only delivered on one side. It's called electroconvulsive therapy. It's at a lower voltage. You know, there are a fair number of differences in terms of also even when it's used, but it remains controversial for a variety of reasons. And one of them is the fact that it's not regulated. It, you know, sort of at a standard level, it's sort of every individual hospital and sometimes, you know, to some extent state level is doing it in their own way. And so there isn't kind of a standardized practice. And so that's what, you know, a lot of people have fought back against, is that, you know, if it is a therapeutic practice that's being offered, like, where are sort of the expectations of standardization across sort of across the whole system?
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw this, or did I read it? I forget where, but I read about
it. While you're reading, it's actually the mention of ECT is quite interesting, because for me particularly, because in a previous existence, I was a registered nurse on a mental health unit, and one of the treatments that I assisted with probably 50 or more times was the administration of ECT therapy,
mm-hmm.
or EC therapy. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, to see, it was shocking. Excuse the pun. There was no pun intended.
Very bad.
But it did seem to be advantageous to the majority of the patients it was prescribed for. And here in the UK, it's done under general anesthesia.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning of psychology, though, I mean, Edmund Freud, for instance, Freud got it wrong.
That was his brother, Edmund.
Yeah, some of them got it wrong. I remember the particular case I was talking about was Prince Philip's mother, who was being treated at a sanatorium, and Freud was there and recommended electric shock. And one of the reasons for this was that it was believed that she was promiscuous, if I can say that word, which I didn't. And the theory was that electrical shock would bring on menstruation and therefore, you know, solve that problem. And Freud went along with that. So in the beginning with electrical shock, they really didn't have 100, you know, really know what they were doing, quite frankly, in today's standards.
Well,
I
would agree, because in terms of ECT, they still largely don't, I would say, don't really understand it. You know, it's kind of given because it's been done for, well, certainly in the hospital I worked at, it was done because it was one of the therapies that they'd always done. Well, at least since Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And I thought, so, I mean, now I feel like I'm kind of on the spot. I thought it was x-rays that they used. It wasn't electroshock, because I could be wrong. But I think in that particular case, it was a different form of therapy.
I could be wrong, Jennifer. I'm not going to deny that, because I'm old, as they say, and I get a lot of information. This whole brain can't handle it. Actually,
would be a perfect candidate.
We got to take a break. Anyways, we got to go. So. Hang on, we'll be right back. Anyways, you're listening to Ghost Chronicles International right here on TojiNet, and we'll be right back after the following messages. Today's show is brought to you by Circles of Wisdom, 286 Merrimack Street, Methuen, Massachusetts, and the Glant Messier Family Law Group, 15 High Street, North Andover, Massachusetts, and our very good friends at Ghost Chronicles right here on Patreon. We'll be right back.
Welcome to TogiNet, radio with a cutting edge.
Do you have a paranormal event, book, or something else you want people to know about? Then why not advertise it on Ghost Chronicles Radio? With over 150,000 downloads a month, get your message out to an audience that's interested in the subject. We have a plan at a cost that fits your needs. For more information, contact Ron Kolick at anyghostproject@comcast.net or call 978-455-6678.
Located in Illinois, there lies a sleepy little town where nothing is a common occurrence.
You going to that party in town tonight?
Heck yeah! I only turned 18 once.
That is until the night of celebration.
Where the hell is she? Oh, no. No, 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 Jessica!
What's happening?
From the creators of Shadowhunters, Bite Me, comes a tale of primal terror. Grindcore mayhem. Shadowhunters, kill Jessica, kill!
And you're welcome back to the second half of the first half of tonight's 2 hours Ghost Chronicles double edition. The next generation to follow our guest tonight on the international edition is Dr. Jennifer Bizarre, who is the assistant director of the Museum and Archive of Psychology in Akron, Ohio.
I'll give you a break.
And the subject of tonight is whether we should have a GoFundMe page to get UECT.
How like can you get that right? You know I would screw that up so badly. Anyway.
I know. But I know so, I can say quintessential so as well. Actually, I would like to ask, I don't know if Jenny could hear the ad break, but...
I could, yes.
Yeah, that's I'd like to...
I apologize for that.
Yeah, I'd like to get a psychologist's impression of that advert.
No, please don't. We have sponsors. Don't do that.
That one might be outside my expertise.
Yeah, I've been to Illinois, and yeah.
They don't talk that way?
I preferred Ohio.
Anyway.
Actually, as a psychologist, I do have a complaint about, because we got off the plane in... Where did we get off the flight? I can't remember. Anyway, we got off the plane and we hired a car, and it was my first encounter driving on US roads, which are the wrong side to begin with. But then, and again, as a psychologist, who designed the street signage in the USA? Because your road names are all wrong. They're kind of like, yeah, messed up.
Says the guy from Wales, who can't put two letters together without throwing a couple extra continents and consonants for no particular reason.
That's because we live near France. But anyway, Sorry, we do have a guest, and it is Dr. Jennifer Bizarre, who is the assistant director of the Museum and Archive of Psychology in Akron.
Okay. So before we go too far, I do want to make sure we get the plug in for the museum, of course. And it is, what are the hours and, what does it cost to get in and, you know, where exactly is it?
Yeah, sure. So we're open Tuesday through Saturday. Most days it's 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then on Wednesdays, we actually do a late night. So we open from 1 p.m. till 8 p.m. And we are located right on the campus of the University of Akron. We're sort of downtown Akron, Ohio, relatively easy to find. Standard admission is $10 for adults, but we have all sorts of discounts for everyone from students to veterans to, families. So it's there's a range of different discounts that would be available. We get visitors actually from all over. We have researchers who regularly are coming from overseas to visit us as well. So it's not intended only as, sort of a resource or, a place to visit for people who are already in the United States, but really as sort of a destination for people coming from anywhere.
I'm curious, why was it sited in Akron as opposed to any other city?
Drink it.
Yeah, we get this question a lot, actually. And it's a really simple answer. It's that our founders, Dr. John Popplestone and Dr. Marion McPherson White, were professors here at the University of Akron. And they came up with the idea to start collecting material related to the history of the field and started writing to psychologists and saying, is anyone preserving your papers? Have you thought about donating your collection? And, that's why we existed just as an archive for such a long time, since 1965. Mm-hmm. And, the collection just kind of kept growing that way.
Now, for instance, Steve belongs to the SBR, and they have a vast library which is available to all its members. Can you become a member of the center and have access as well?
You can. So you can become a friend of the museum, of the center. But it really, at that point, it's more about just sort of supporting us. We're a nonprofit organization. We exist on donations. And so it's more of that kind of membership. Anybody can visit the museum. You don't need to have any sort of formal affiliation with anybody. And anybody can use our archives as well. So absolutely, that applies to any type of researcher, whether it's somebody who's doing casual research for their personal interest, or somebody who is doing it for an academic interest, or you're making a documentary, or, you know, whatever it might be. There's no membership required to access our services.
You know, I think you've highlighted one of the great tragedies of the present generation, in that archives are not publicly funded, that they're not, they exist on visitor donations, legacy donations, wills, and it's an appalling way to treat what is, an important part of the present, which is our past.
But that's also not only just in that type of archives, but you know that, like, I'm so involved in all historical preservation, yeah, that all those organizations are private, and they're the only ones doing it, unless it's the National Park or something. You are
I think that is, one of the great tragedies of the present generation, the present era that we're in, that we treat our history with reverence, but at governmental level and at national level, it kind of doesn't matter.
Well, it depends on the type of archive or museum that you are, right? Like, I mean, there are national level and state level archives, which, the best of my understanding, although this is a naive understanding, I'll admit, suddenly I'm doubting myself, but do receive public funding. It's sort of the rest of us who, a good number of archives and museums do operate on donation. I'm not going to disagree with the fact that it would be lovely to see more support.
I think it's something that we, as a society, we should recognize the importance of archives and of historical material, because a lot of it, even within parapsychology, a huge amount of our archives have disappeared. Because they were never considered to be important. There are groups that are, or organizations, universities that are starting to gather it back together again, but so much of the material has been disseminated into private collections or landfill in many cases, sadly. And it's a tragedy, not just for the field of my interest, but for many, people who are interested in railroad memorabilia, railroad history, shipping history. You can pick any subject, but to throw away our history or to disregard our history, I think he's one of the great tragedies.
Well, they're trying to change it here in the States. So why, the history, our history doesn't, meet with today's standards. So,
well, we could discuss that politically, because the reason, if we had better archives or better archive resourcing, then there would be less revision of history.
Yeah, it'll get buried. People do what they want to do with, unfortunately.
That's a political thing that
we get into it anyways, but yeah. Yeah, I know. So Jennifer, the psychology, Steve has written a couple of books on ghosts and stuff, because that's what we do, of course. We're involved in parapsychology, and I used to teach paranormal CSI at the college, but a big part of that was psychology. Steve's famous saying is, I know what I saw, which is definitely flawed. And you have, simple things that, like the gorilla experiment. What's that called, Steve? The gorilla goes through the bouncing ball thing.
I think it's just called the gorilla experiment.
Okay, that works too. But anyways, are you familiar with that?
Man in a gorilla suit.
I am, yeah. It's sort of one of the classic films that are shown in introductory psychology classes. Exactly. I always love that one.
Yeah. So, yeah. Psychology is such an important part of our lives, and it's actually an important part of our lives in science as well, you know, trying to understand why things happen, not only just by measuring science, just measuring things, but also, okay, it's this is doing this and this is doing it, but what is the, why, you know, is it different? Why are we seeing changes? We want that to understanding of deviances from what we expect a lot of times. Or we become so enthralled with the norm that we ignore the abnormalities, which is sometimes an important part of the readings that we take.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, all of the sciences sort of have that same underlying goal of, you know, sort of measuring the whatever aspect of the world around us, you know, in order to understand it as a way also then of being able to predict whatever that event is to recur, you know, as a sign that we have understood it. But, you know, there's a lot of aspects that just sort of are out of our reach still.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have even animal psychology, right? How animals mm-hmm. respond to different stimuli and different environments and so forth. But going back to the museum, what is your, to you as a director there, and you've been there for a while?
I've been here for 3 years now.
Okay, 3 years. Do you have one exhibit that's kind of really your favorite that you if you go into the museum, you got to see it?
I have lots of favorites.
Yeah, I know you would.
Probably, you know, my the place I feel most comfortable in terms of like where I want to have, you know, just the non-ending conversations, and I have to like, you know, sort of pull myself back to give visitors a chance to continue seeing the rest of the museum is the first hallway where we do talk about mental health care. So my background is like my specialty in terms of history of psychology is in the history of institutions for mental health care. So, you know, sort of the old asylums and state hospitals. And it represents such a long, you know, so basically like, you know, 150 years, 200 years in the United States in terms of our mental health history. And so it has such a wide reach and so many different aspects to it and still influences, you know, us today in various ways that I'm utterly fascinated by it all the time and always want to get lost in conversation about this. Yeah, there's lots of books out there already, but...
There should be a book on it. I mean, really, I mean, that is so intriguing. Imagine the beginnings of mental hospitals to the present day. I mean, we look at, you know, we think the science is so exact and so... you know, definite that we look at the mistakes we actually saw by misinterpreting what we propose, what the theses are, and how we actually make these mistakes, and they're accepted. But it's only through years and years of a lot of times independent thought that brings about changes, saying, "Oh my God, no, this is all wrong. I can't believe we did this."
Isn't it? I don't necessarily think that's the case, Ron. I would argue that what no, I would suggest because we had some notable asylums here in the UK, Bethlehem Asylum being possibly the most notable. And I think change came about by visionary individuals who looked at the situations and the circumstances that the poor individuals confined to these asylums were being placed in and said, This is appalling. This has to stop. And I don't think there's been a gradual process. It's been a step change process, a paradigm shift of, you know, awakening the consciousness.
Enlightenment.
Enlightenment. That was the word I was looking for. Of people who were, I mean, 200 years ago, you could pay your shilling and go and stare at the patients. In these asylums, it was considered to be a fun family day out.
Cal Cooper still does it, does he?
But, you know, then you have, as with the slave trade, you have people who said, this is appalling. We cannot treat people this way. And they affect change often by, you know, protest, by writing to Parliament, to writing to their representatives and saying, and highlighting the problems. That's how change came about, I believe.
I like it,
and that's accurate too. I mean, it really is both people within the medical system as well as actually people who were in it, like sort of as patients themselves. There was an entire patient rights movement that sort of pushed back against some of the care and experiences they were having within these institutions. But there's also, you know, the factor of adoption of psychopharmaceuticals and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of factors that all combine, but I would agree that there's sort of this paradigm shift that happens, but that's also where institutions came from, right? There was a response, especially on this side of the ocean. The UK has a little bit of a longer history, whereas in the United States, our early institutions were coming out as a response to the conditions within like the county jails. Mm-hmm. And that they would have people there who were labeled with this old label of insanity, who were essentially just sort of locked up. And it was seen as, you know, the civil responsibility to take care of them. And we looked over to Europe to see what they were doing, and they were building these institutions and we copied that. And so, you know, there's sort of these shifts that happened both at the beginning and the end of that whole era.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, what's the modern psychologist's view of, because we have, and I believe the situation is the same in America, we have closed down all of these large sanatoriums, institutions, asylums, which some of the patients from within them who were cast out into the community are bemoaning the fact that they didn't have, they now no longer have this safe environment in which they can live. And modern society is, you know, deeply challenging to them, and they are questioning whether there is a model to bring back some form of asylum.
They maybe got rid of the big institutions, but there are still available organizations that will.
Yeah, but I mean, largely the patients are out in the community now, which was 20 years ago.
They have like halfway houses that are available.
I was asking the psychologist.
Oh, excuse me.
Well, the process here was the same in terms of sort of the after effects of the deinstitutionalization process. And so you have thousands upon thousands of people who were confined within these institutions because that was what the mental health care system was, right? Yeah, it took place at an institution. And so when we started to close a lot of those facilities, and Ron, you're not incorrect. We still have mental health facilities of various forms. Some of them are inpatient, some of them are outpatient, but it's no longer the focus of the system. So the majority of people receiving mental health care services today are no longer, acquiring those services through an institution of that sort. But the problem when we started to close down the buildings was that there was this huge sort of influx into the community of people who had been institutionalized for long periods of time, who didn't have the supports, whether that was, you know, personal family supports or friends or financial or education or work experience, you know, on top of sort of adapting to, you know, being outside of the institution, trying to find, you know, where you're going to live and, you know, what you're going to do for work, while also trying to find new services to support any continuing mental health concerns that you might have. And unfortunately, it led to, you know, sort of this massive spike in terms of our unhoused population that, you know, is still radiating today.
Mm-hmm. So we are coming down towards the end of the show. And Jennifer, I'd like to ask you a question. Now, if you don't want to answer, you absolutely feel free not to. Okay, because it might be a little bit of controversy. We are so quick to judge the past from the present that we totally miss the whole idea that we don't understand what the mindset of these people were at the time. For instance, things that were accepted that are no longer accepted today is what it's judged on. And we see that as terrible today, but at that time it was acceptable. So those people weren't as, what's the word? I can't think of one up here, but bad.
Malevolent.
Okay. Yeah, as we think they are. Am I wrong with this or
No, I fully agree with that. I think that it's really easy to cast kind of a negative shadow over the past and to look at it as though we know so much more today. And I think it's important then to flip the coin and think about what will people think of us 100 years from now? You know, we're constantly in a process of learning. You know, we're always going to be in a different place from, you know, the earlier days, but we also continue to learn from the past. I mean, there are practices, you know, both within mental health care or, you know, other field, or other areas of psychology that are being brought back today, right? So it's, you never know. It's sort of a cyclical type of relationship as opposed to like a continuous timeline that we can't sort of come back to. But I always think that if we just look at people, most people are very well-intentioned, right? We want the best for ourselves and for those around us. And so if we look at history with that same kind of vision, then I think often, not always, I mean, there are some evil characters in our history, but we'll often see sort of that genuine attempt to improve society in some way. And if we look at it with that lens, we might sort of interpret things a bit differently.
And history does progress. It may progress slowly at times, but it does progress. I mean, we look at, I mean, just look at the woman's right to vote. You know, that's not that long ago, I hate to tell you. You know, and simple things like that. I mean, the founding fathers, when they founded the country, you were had to own land or be a, I forget what the other term is, but you know, not everybody had the right to vote in this country back then, even. So it progressed, but it progressed slowly at times, which is, you know, great for, you know, revolution and not, I mean, social revolution, not necessarily.
January the 6th.
Yeah, thank you. No. But anyways, so it does progress, but we sometimes lose our patience with it, I think, and we try to push it a little bit farther sometimes, and it does. And then sometimes we regress as well, so it is what it is. But
yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what is it? Oh, God. What is with today's society in that we no longer have that same attitude where we allow other people to be have their own thoughts in reality. We tend to be very, very divided. In other words, my thoughts are the only thoughts that's right. And why have we gotten this way? I mean, it wasn't like that in the 60s when it was all love child and, that type of thing. It's kind of progressed into this dividedness in our society today. Why do you think that has happened that way? That's a big question.
I don't know if the 60s are the best example of a lack of division. I mean, it's an era of huge divisions, right? They were just different from those that we're focused on today. I don't know what has necessarily contributed to the current divisions, but unfortunately, I think it's something that has defined us for, you know, a long time in history, that there's often been multiple opinions on the same topic, and we have not always seen eye to eye. And, you know, eventually these things do sort of come to a head through things like, you know, civil rights movements and that kind of thing have brought about change. I wish we didn't have such a deep divide.
Yeah. When I was thinking about the 60s, I was thinking of flower children, you know, live and let live.
You had the rose-colored lenses on.
Yeah, there you go.
I was going to say, I'm a child of the 60s, and I didn't see it as, I remember the protests against Vietnam, ban the bomb.
Yeah, you know, but they went, the flower children put the little flowers in the guns of the state troopers before they shot them. You know, it was nice, you know. I agree with you. Yeah. I know what you're saying. It was very divided, and it wasn't
we were hellishly divided.
I stand corrected.
We were divided, I think, at a lower level in terms of, as a nation, we weren't divided. As a people, we weren't divided, but we were divided on many issues.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now it's becoming, or at least here in the UK, it seems to be becoming more of we tend to bother about things that ordinarily we worry about offending people far more.
Yeah.
We worry about how to address people far more.
I don't want to offend you, Steve, but we just about run out of time, and I do want Jennifer to, if there's anything that you definitely want to bring up, now's a good time, Jennifer. If there's about the museum.
I mean, I think we've covered a lot in our discussion. I mean, my only message would be that, I hope that your listeners, if they're passing through Akron, Ohio, that they stop and see us at the National Museum of Psychology. We'd love to continue the conversation in person with them.
There are many exhibits that, from what you were saying earlier, I would love to see personally.
Yeah, me too. I also will put up the website on our social pages and so forth as well.
Oh, thank you.
And if you can actually go and check this out, I mean, when I put it up, check it out, because they've got the floor plan of the place. They've got a lot of really cool shots and exhibits. They got upcoming events and stuff, and it's really a great place. And I love museums. When I was a kid, I used to pretend I had a museum. So,
and now you are a living museum.
I know it. It's so sad. So anyways, we do have to go. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you had a good time anyways.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Mm-hmm. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
You're welcome, yeah. Steve.
Good choice of guest. Very good choice of guest.
Anyways,
am I going to do the fun fact of the day?
Give me the fun fact.
Did you know that bees can survive a week underwater?
Ah, that's amazing. Anyways, we got to go. Stay tuned for Ghost Chronicles Next Generation, and check us out on all your platforms. So good night, everyone. God bless. Jennifer, thank you very much. Steve, it's always a pleasure speaking to you.
Well, good night, I think everyone. First time, God bless Jennifer for coming on the show and surviving.
Yeah, I know it. She survived. That's the big thing.
Thank you, Jenny.
Anytime.
Ghoulies to ghosties, long-leggedy beasties, and things that go bump in the night. Deliver us, good Lord.